You're listening to the FQXI podcast. I'm Zia Morali. Welcome to the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. Well, this is very good timing, or at least this edition is about good timing, as we're going to be talking about the most precise clocks that have been made and fundamental limits on how precise clocks can ever become. This year's $3 million breakthrough prize for fundamental physics is shared between two optical physicists, Jun Yi of JILA, formerly known as the Joint Institute for Laboratory Astrophysics at the University of Colorado Boulder, and Hidetoshi Katori of the University of Tokyo in Japan. They developed the optical lattice clock, a device that is 10,000 times more precise than state-of-the-art atomic clocks and would lose less than 1 second in over 15 billion years. Early in September, I wrote an article for Nature about the prizes, and I got the chance to speak with Yi to congratulate him on his win and ask him more about how optical lattice clocks work. I also wanted to find out how the clocks can teach us more about the foundations of physics by allowing the best ever tests of general relativity, for instance, and also their practical applications for detecting seismic activity and sea level rise, and possibly even their use for testing dark matter. In Yi's words, a network of optical lattice clocks can work both as a telescope and as a microscope, allowing us to probe physics across a variety of scales with unprecedented accuracy. Ironically, given his research, Yi was late to the call.
Hi, Zia. I'm so sorry. I want to deeply apologize to you for wasting your time.
You've set yourself up for a joke about working in precision timekeeping and exactly. Then being late. So.
I was just worried about that particular aspect.
Let me just tell you, while you're sort of settling down, congratulations, well done on this amazing award.
Oh, certainly. I felt very honored. The honor goes into many of my colleagues, and particularly, I think, my students who have worked with me over the past 20 years for this.
How did you get involved in this whole area? Why was precision timekeeping something you were interested in?
So I've always been interested in quantum optics. And then when I was pursuing a PhD, I studied under Dr. John Hall, who shared the Nobel Prize in 2005. And Jan is known for developing many laser frequency stabilization techniques. There is this tradition in this institution called JILA, and Jan really represents that spirit, which is, well, I can build a scientific instrument from scratch. And if I put my mind to it, I can build the very best one, making measurements limited only by laws of nature, but not by my technical sloppiness and so on. That's always the model. So like the combination of being able to build things with your own hands and use this to apply to measure something really, really well, something to do with quantum, that just felt really right to me.
You know, as you're going along, are you driven just by the desire to make something more perfect, more precise, you know, limited only by nature? Or are you in parallel, you know, what applications are you thinking of? Or is it just purely the kind of challenge of trying to kind of climb this mountain or whatever leave the applications to somebody else?
I think this is an excellent question. And it's actually very intriguing because I must admit at the beginning, I know clock is very applicable. You know, and of course, we know that it's involving our daily life. And early on, I also knew how important clock is for our communication, for navigations, for many things. But I have to say the one thing that drove me the most at the beginning was this idea that if I keep pushing the limit of being able to measure time better and better, and that just kind of excites me, the idea that you can do measurements so well that you, one day you may be able to probe the one part of the very microscopic side of our world, which is described by quantum mechanics, and the gravity and so on are the macroscopic of our world, of the universe and so on. And somehow having them connected, even just the fact that, well, in the quantum mechanics, in such a small scale of things, you actually have to worry about time may be different due to the general relativity of time dilation. Oftentimes, it's just that one intuitive feel, or maybe this gut feeling that this will be interesting.
Traditional state-of-the-art cesium atomic clocks, which are currently used to define the length of the second, keep time by measuring microwaves that are regularly emitted as the cesium atoms transition between two internal energy states. Optical lattice clocks are able to better them by measuring the optical light emitted by strontium atoms. Optical light has a frequency that is 100,000 times higher than microwaves, meaning that you can use optical light to measure faster ticks of your clock. The technology required to make this switch from microwaves to optical light is based on a number of advances over the past decades, many of which earned Nobel Prizes in their own right and were developed by Yi's early career mentors.
In 1997, I received my PhD and went to Caltech, and I took on a postdoc position with Professor Jeff Kimball. And he is one of the pioneers in the field called cavity QED, which is to study the nature of how photons interacting with atoms. 2 years later, Jella hired me back and actually studied, really delve into building an optical atomic clock. And luck has it, there was a revolution called optical frequency cone technology got developed. And this was a concept that was initially pioneered by a German physicist, Ted Hinsch. The frequency cone, it's like a bridge that will allow you to connect a microwave frequency that we know we can count with electronics to the optical frequency that's at a, such a higher frequency than a, basically a million times higher frequency. And it's conventional electronics has no way of counting those frequencies. So even if I wanted to build using a quantum pendulum of electrons around the nucleus to build atomic clock in the optical frequency domain, in the visible spectrum, without the tool of frequency comb, you wouldn't be able to tell the time. You wouldn't be able to connect the handle of the clock to something that you can tell people what time it is. So that was a very important key piece of technology. And I just want to thank Jane Hall and Ted Hinsch. They were the one who laid the foundation, the technical foundation. And we just pushed that forward to this current state of the art. And for that, Jane Hall and Ted Hinsch won the Nobel Prize in 2005.
As its name suggests, the optical lattice clock also involves arranging atoms in a regular array, or a lattice. By contrast, old-fashioned cesium atomic clocks drop clouds of atoms in a fountain fashion. So keeping the atoms in the new-style optical lattice clock as still as possible also helps to improve the clock's accuracy over its predecessor. But holding the atoms in place required further Nobel Prize-winning technological innovations to keep the atoms cold so that they don't jiggle about due to the heat, and to physically trap them with lasers.
Well, I should have mentioned three other really Nobel Prizes that was also very recent, including, for example, how do you make atoms really cold? Because if the atom is going to act as a clock, you cannot afford to have it move around so fast because Einstein's relativity will tell you time is all different. For example, we know that the cesium clock that people use to define the current time has been very good. The current technology uses the cesium atom in so-called a fountain regime, where you cool cesium atoms down to low temperatures and you throw them up. You know, this allows you to have interaction time to be really long as the cesium is flying up and down. As you throw the stone into the sky and come back down, it takes about a second. That's considered a very, very long time for laser field, or at the time is, of course, microwave, to interact with atom. So, but I want to work on optical side. I do not want to work on the microwave. That's because optics gives you the pendulum swing that, if I use that analogy, much, much faster than the microwave. You know, the people have been chasing for this increased so-called interaction time. When you want to make something measured really, really well, you have to study that object for a long time. And that's literally speaking, you know, if you want to build an atom as your clock, you have to keep that atom for a long time because you want to look at this quantum coherence. Or another way of saying it, imagine there's a little pendulum inside the atom that's swinging, which in the case of the cesium, it's the electron spin. In my case, it's the electronic motion around the nucleus. If I want to build an accurate clock, I want to keep atom in front of me for a long period of time so I can study that swing of the quantum pendulum. And so making coherence really long is a key. And also, I do not want to work in the microwave domain. I want to work in the optical domain. that's because the pendulum swings a lot faster. And if it swings a lot faster, you can measure better. The problem comes with optics is, well, the wavelength of optics is much, much shorter than the microwave. Therefore, any atomic motion will traverse several wavefronts. It's like you are surfing on a very violent ocean. In that kind of a scenario, we want atom to be stationary as possible. So we cannot afford to throw the atoms up anymore in the optical domain. So you have to somehow make the atoms stop moving. And this is a technique called the laser cooling of atoms. You probably know three physicists won Nobel Prize in 1997. I know all of them. So it's my grow up experience of knowing, you know, these were such an exciting frontiers of physics during my PhD. And that become a foundational technology that I needed to build atomic clock. The other Nobel Prizes in 2001, they were able to cool atoms to such low temperatures that in quantum mechanics, we always say there's a particle wave duality. And when temperature is really low, the nature of a wave shows up of atom. And you can actually get into this mind-boggling theoretical quantum state like a Bose-Einstein condensation, actually realized right in front of you, in your eye, in the middle of the vacuum chamber. So that's pretty exciting. And it turns out later, we're going to use that technology also for improving clocks. And the fourth one I want to mention is actually two more. The fourth one is Dave Wineland and Serge Haroche, a French scientist. They shared Nobel Prize in 2012. Their prize was quantum state engineering of a single particle. And turns out that's the key story for making clocks. You want to control the quantum states of the individual particles. It's just that what Katori and I are doing, we use many more than just one. Because if you got 1,000 atoms to employ, why settle on one? You'll get a much bigger signal. And so that was another key piece. The final one is the 2018 Nobel Prize given to Arthur Ashkin for his invention of technology called optical tweezers. You can shine a laser beam into the middle of the vacuum chamber and hold onto an atom or a particle. And the idea is very simple, that any object can be polarized by electrical field. Just like if you comb your hair, that comb will be charged and you can actually use that to pick up a piece of paper from the ground. And so we are using that technology to trap atoms in the middle of the vacuum chamber and then use that to build a clock. So all of these technologies come in. That's why it's a long-winded answer to the question you're asking why I got into this.
The pieces to build the optical lattice clock seemed to be in place by the late 1990s, but there was still a significant challenge to be overcome. The act of trapping the atom disturbs it. So how can you be sure that it is giving you an accurate time reading rather than some distorted measurement?
So that sounds all good. You know, you can cool them down and put them in a trap, a cage made out of light. But there is one particularly important breakthrough point, and this is really where the Katori's contribution and my contribution come through. You are turning a free atom into a prisoner because you're trapping it. So now you ask the atom, what time is it? You know, you have to make sure the atom is happy to tell you the time because it's being imprisoned. And so that's, you know, this really is actually a key question. How can we solve this competition? Well, on one hand, we needed to have atom to be trapped so I can look at it for a long time. On the other hand, how do you avoid the perturbation of the act of trapping itself on the clock frequency? That was a key challenge, and I think we solved it by looking at study the atomic energy level structures. The trapping itself is going to distort the energy structure of the atom. That's unavoidable. But in the end, you care about only two energy states that supports the clock, because in the end, the clock is measuring the energy separation between the two atomic states. What if those two atomic states have exactly the same distortion by the trapping laser beam? Well, now you solve this problem because on one hand, both atomic states will be distorted, and that's giving your atom to be trapped. But at the same time, the difference between these two atomic states is not bothered by the presence of the trapping beam. And so you can still make atomic clock measurement in the presence of the trapping laser beam. And that's a key breakthrough. And this idea of trapping atoms, but it's not being bothered by the trapping itself when you look at a particular atomic state, was actually the idea when I was at Jeff Kimball's place that we came up together. And the Katori independence, we came up with that idea in Japan. So you can see these already coming in together. And then the final piece where I mentioned, once these atoms are loaded in the traps, you want to cool them down so low, such a low temperature where they occupy in quantum mechanical states inside the trap. So it's not only the atom itself, the internal structure is quantized. Now the entire atom, center of mass motion, the entire atom inside the external trapping potential is also quantized. Once you can do that, then the rest is just, let's do that 1,000 times over. Once you can achieve this, that's our current generation of clocks now.
Optical lattice clocks offer unprecedented precision. Sometimes this has led to unexpected applications, such as the development of a breath analyzer in Yi's lab. The key, says Yi, is to be open to new ideas as you are building the clocks.
If your eye is opened when you are moving the technology frontier forward, so the application actually comes naturally. And we actually, for example, using that technology, we have developed breath analyzer using frequency combs of lasers. Because you ask people to donate a breath sample into your vacuum chamber, you can measure all kinds of molecules that's contained in your breath. And this is like miles, miles away from building atomic clock. These days, people asking me, well, Dr. E, you have a clock that can measure gravitational potential to a centimeter. Your clock literally changes time when you move it up and down on the surface of the Earth by a centimeter. There must be lots of application, right? You know, use this to possibly detect continental drift, measuring the polar ice cap, measuring the global warming, monitoring potentially volcanoes. I would say, well, we need it. First of all, we probably need to go to 10 to minus 19. And the second, we need to take this technology out of the lab. So it needs a lot of engineering. The clock, like I'm talking about, is a room full of equipment. But fortunately, now that people see the importance of the application, but many groups now are putting the effort in making the system transportable to make it compact. So that is really going to drive some major applications. I would say it's not like, oh, if you build it, people will come. But rather, you have to build it. You have to keep your mind open. You have to communicate to the scientific community that what are the new capabilities that this will be coming. So that's an exciting aspect of scientific work. Right now, optical clock technology, as I say, that's starting to come out of the lab, even Katori's lab, they're starting to make these clocks to be mounted on the racks, that way you start to can be transportable. And once you get this out of the door into the field, you can start to measure geodetic relativity effects. I think turning clock into a very powerful tool to measure geoactivities will be a powerful application in the coming decade. Use this to monitor the environmental changes on Earth. If we can continue to push the state of the clocks further, one could start to imagine place this around the active areas of earthquake or volcanoes will allow you to make predictions.
Yi shares the breakthrough prize with Hidetoshi Katori, whose group, as he mentioned, has already taken the clocks into the field. They've used them to perform the most precise ground-based tests of Einstein's general theory of relativity ever. Katori placed clocks at the base and at the top of Tokyo's Skytree Tower and showed that they tick at different rates due to their difference in height. And physicists, including Yi, are looking for ways to use the clocks to test other foundational aspects of physics. Some involve space-based tests to detect gravitational waves, ripples in the fabric of space-time, or lab-based tests to identify dark matter, the mysterious substance thought to make up the bulk of matter in the universe.
There are another set of applications that people are really interested into is to make the clock small enough that it can go to satellites. And now if you start to build a network of satellite with the state-of-the-art clocks, first of all, it's going to be really important to define time from space because Earth is just a rocking boat. It's a very lively place. And then as we said, it's space and time are interconnected by relativity. So if Earth is moving around, your time is also moving around. In space, it's quieter. But more than that, if you develop a network of clocks like that, and I often use this analogy, it turns into the clock into a telescope. Because you connect these satellites, you can actually look into the universe you can actually see gravitational wave. You know, when black hole explodes, gravitational wave come to the Earth. You don't have to use interferometers to measure like LIGO does. And we actually published a paper saying what will be needed to really use the clock to measure gravitational waves. But you can also use this to poke some of the mysteries in the universe. You may have heard dark matter. The reason why physicists chose the word dark is because they have no clue what that is. We know it exists. We know because it's holding galaxies tighter, seems to be, than ordinary matter. But we just have no clue how they interact with ordinary matter. You know, we have no signature how they interact other than gravitational potential. So if you have clocks like this, maybe because you can measure time so accurately, and the measurement of time is based on quantum phenomena, what if the dark matter actually interacts with ordinary field, like electromagnetic field, or ordinary particles like electrons? Then inevitably, your time, as measured by atomic system, will change due to the presence of dark matter. So if you have a network of them, maybe you will be able to use this to detect dark matter in the end. This has already started. We actually published a paper last year to use clock to provide the best bound on certain energy scales for the existence of the ultralight dark matter. I made this analogy that looks into it, like it becomes a telescope. You can also think of the clock network as like becoming a microscope, because as we mentioned earlier, you can turn upwards to look into the heaven or look downward of the Earth and see that, you know, all the global changes of the Earth, the geode shifting with a much higher sensitivity with increased clock precision and accuracy.
And I wonder, you know, you're talking about these applications, which actually, although they may be sort of future applications, they're sort of within the realms of touching distance. But, you know, you spoke earlier about being so excited about quantum aspects and trying to probe deeper. And I wonder if you sort of have an eye on even thinking about the nature of time itself, whether time is discrete or continuous, whether it's granular, whether it's, you know, when you're talking about quantum effects, picking up on fuzziness at the level of time, uncertainty, and, you know, really weird stuff about time itself. Is that something that you think about of the very far future, perhaps?
Yeah, that's very, very, very far in the future. And I think I do think about it. I think the discreteness of time, that's really far. What you're describing, perhaps, are in this really quantum gravity string theory. If your measurements accuracy or precision continue to advance, maybe one day you'll hit the discreteness of time. But that's 20-something orders of magnitude away. And I think before you hit that, you will see other things that's going to be a limitation. And I actually thought quite a bit about what could limit your time. For example, one thing that's for sure going to limit you is that the universe itself is also very lively. It's just not at the lively scale of the Earth. As you know, the black holes popping in and pop out, and produce gravitational waves. Neutron stars collide with each other. New stars are born. There's a lot of a gravitational wave, a lot of a ripples of space-time that's happening in the universe. When we first were able to see gravitational wave with LIGO, people just really jumped up and down to celebrate because that opened up a completely new window to look at our universe. But imagine that your clock is so good that you will finally be limited by the symphony of the universe because you know, neutron stars exploding. So where do you escape? Where do you go? There's no place to hide but having your time being perturbed by all of these various different galaxies' activities because space and time is connected. So that might be the end of our human race, how to make a clock, so we get to see how. But that probably would mean that we would have already conquered the solar system. We would become an interstellar civilization. You start to see the edge of the universe echoes from coming back from the edge of the universe. That's a scientific fiction for sure, but one has to think about that.
Thank you to Jun Yi for speaking with me earlier in September. And congratulations again to him and Hidetoshi Katori for their breakthrough prize win. I mentioned that I spoke with Yi for an article I was writing for Nature on the Breakthrough Prize winners, and I'll link to that story on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast. There you can also read about the other winners in the life sciences and in mathematics. Unsurprisingly, the prizes this year were dominated by research that has helped the effort to track COVID around the globe and how it's been shifting and changing in all the different variants, and the program to produce coronavirus vaccines, particularly mRNA vaccines. Now, in our interview, Yi spoke about the limits he foresees in making ever more accurate clocks. I loved his line about the clocks eventually being limited by the symphony of the universe. Such clocks would be so sensitive that they could be used, as he described, to pick up gravitational waves. And as you push down further, you may find that you simply cannot shield the clocks from that noise, the cacophony of collisions between black holes and neutron stars.